Thank you, Kathy, and good morning, everyone. So, if you're like me, for years, I would really be appreciating the presentations that you just heard about the importance of working in multiple sectors when you're in public health and of really thinking about health and all policies in a community focus. You might have felt like I did as both a city and a state commissioner that I just didn't know how I was going to do it because I got only categorical funding that was limited. I couldn't really figure out where I was going to get the ability to have people who would invest in doing the important work of making the connections to housing and to doing health impact assessments and to thinking about the collaborative approach that Dr. Mullen was mentioning. And so what I want to present to you today is a vision for where we might go in terms of both the healthcare delivery system and the public health system that might allow for the freeing up of resources so that we can devote them to the places that they need to be devoted. And in framing that, I'd start by saying that this is an issue that's of enormous importance to the Centers for Disease Control. These are the three strategic directions that that have been established at CDC under the leadership of our director, Dr. Frieden. And the one that I'm going to focus on today is talking about the strengthening the public health and healthcare collaboration, because I would make the argument that we're in a seminal moment now in terms of health. And that moment allows us the possibility of having the healthcare delivery system with its enormous amount of resources direct more of those resources towards prevention with a sensitivity towards the social determinants of health and a connection to community agencies on the one hand, and on the other hand, freeing up the public health departments to work more at upstream and to spend more time establishing the important kind of linkages that are necessary with our partners in other sectors. So, first of all, how is that going to happen? And I'd start by saying, by answering the question of just why would I say this is a significant moment in history, one that's filled with opportunity? And it's because there's some really remarkable things happening that we may know about, but it's really worth thinking about those at where we are in history. So I'll mention those as four significant trends. The first one, I just don't think we can underestimate enough the significance of the expansion of healthcare access to populations that didn't have health insurance before, and disproportionately people who were poor and people of color. And so getting to the point within one year, where the population from 18 to 64-year-olds in the country that were uninsured went from 21% down to 13% is a very unusual moment in history. It's a very significant moment, the possibility of 16 million more people having health insurance. It really, from a public health perspective, it's just good. We know people get healthier if they get health insurance, but it also means some of the resources we've historically invested in doing safety net services has the potential now to be freed up and moved to be more directed towards upstream. This gives you just some sense, again, in what happened in one year. This is the percentage of those who are uninsured, and this looks at it. This is with our most recent data. This is just breaking data we're releasing now on the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey for 2014 being the key year in terms of the implementation of major components of the Affordable Care Act. And you can just see, like, across the board, when we're looking at folks who have either disabilities or impaired functioning, we've seen a significant reduction in those who didn't have health insurance. So the flip side of that is an increase in those who have access to health insurance and access to the services that will keep them healthier and ideally have a preventive focus. We thought at first that this was not going to be a national phenomenon, that we were only going to see this happening in the states that had Medicaid expansion. This again is from the BRFSS 2014 survey, and those states with the darker colors are the ones that had the largest increase in the percentage of insured within their state. So you can look at states like Mississippi and Florida and Oklahoma, states that didn't expand Medicaid, and they had among the largest increases in terms of the insured as low-income people got subsidies from the exchanges, and as some people, and we've heard this from a number of the states, some of the people who would go on to the exchange would find out they'd always been eligible for Medicaid. They weren't eligible with the expansion, they'd always been eligible, they just didn't know that. So traditional Medicaid expanded in a number of these different states. So truly, there's a national phenomenon of increased access to health care, which may have an impact on health care, on public health as well. The second big trend, so that's trend number one, the second big trend is the movement away from fee-for-service to value-based contracting. You know, and as a public health guy, you know, for years I just didn't pay attention to insurance and the kind of the vagaries of one kind of policy versus another. This is like core public health for us now. We really need to know the significance of the changes in insurance. Fee-for-service is volume-based reimbursement. Value-based contracting is the possibility of creating financial incentives for not only quality of care, but for health outcomes. And health outcomes meaning people stay healthier rather than they get hospitalized when they need to be hospitalized. It really emphasizes with an incentive, what will it take to keep your patients healthy? And that creates the possibility from public health and preventive perspective that some of the things that were not historically paid for under fee-for-service could actually be paid for by the healthcare delivery system with all of its resources if we take advantage of those opportunities. And so thinking about how to do that is key. This is just one example of how quickly this is happening. CMS, through the Innovation Center, spent $1 billion with states giving very large grants for the state innovation model grants that within a four-year period, if you're a testing state, you have to get to 80% of the people in your state on value-based contracting, moving away from fee-for-service, and 80% have to be cared for in a patient-centered medical home. These are really big grants. These aren't small $60,000 grants. These are grants the size of New York State's, which was $100 million. So when CMS is giving you $100 million, you can take more seriously the goal of making those big conversions, and these states are doing it. The third big trend is the shift to what's the right clinical model. And we now, for the first time, have an official federal recommendation about what's the right way to receive care, and it's through a patient-centered medical home. And, you know, that really is kind of what public health in many ways has been arguing is necessary in terms of the way that care is provided. A patient-centered medical home is accessible, it's comprehensive, covering all the different services, ideally under one roof. It carves in behavioral health. It offers the potential for having trauma-informed care by carving in a concern for the holistic approach. It's much more likely to be linked to community providers. FQHCs are often the poster child for what a patient-centered medical home is, but we're seeing more and more of this. It's potential, but it's also a real trend. This just gives you some sense of its impact again in just 1 year. This is the new BRFSS data that says what states showed a statistically significant increase in the people when surveyed saying that they now had a primary care provider that didn't, that previously just sought episodic care in emergency rooms or when needed. The states that are blue had a statistically significant increase in 1 year in the residents of the state saying, I now have a primary care provider. And again, disproportionately, we're seeing that these are likely to be the patient-centered medical homes. What's the fourth trend? The fourth trend, unlike the first three, which is about the healthcare delivery system, is about the public health system. And here, there is the reality that our resources have gone down at the local, state, and federal level, and that they're unlikely to come back in general, although there's some places where they've seen returns in some area. But in general, we're not seeing a return to the 52,000 jobs that have been lost since 2008. And while the resources are down, and that really forces public health to focus and say, what are we going to do with our more limited dollars that's going to make a difference? How are we going to use those dollars so that they can focus on areas like working with other sectors, thinking about social determinants of health? It means we have to think about where to put the emphasis with the more limited dollars. And there's excellent work that's being done in terms of that to grapple with what are the core public health activities, what's foundational capabilities, and presenting a new notion of the health departments of the future. So what does these trends mean in terms of public health, right? And how should we take advantage of them? So I would share with you that one framework that CDC is using regularly is to think that our opportunity to promote health or promote prevention should occur in three different lanes or buckets simultaneously, and that we should always be focusing on the three, because if we don't always focus on the three, we'll be pulled into discussions on just one or the other and we'll lose some opportunities. So what are the three? Well, the first one I'd start with is traditional clinical approaches to prevention and health. And here what I'm talking about is things like just making sure people get immunizations, they get screened for diseases. If they're diagnosed with high blood pressure, they get the medication that will allow them to control their high blood pressure. It isn't enough for us to say people now have health care coverage and therefore those things will automatically happen. These percentages, they've gone up a little bit in the last few years, but there's some indication of where we are not and need to be with the primary care that goes on now. So why do I say that's a role for public health? I think it's a key role for public health. Many of the reasons that these things are covered at all by insurance is because public health has shown that they work and has sometimes modeled programs that are effective in grants that later were paid for. But we have a critical role in terms of the public health field in a number of different ways, and among those different ways are, I'll go back for a second, are public information campaigns and highlighting best practices and sometimes funding pilot programs which show how you can reach higher percentages of particularly high-risk populations. To help in terms of that, CDC has now developed a project known as the 618 Project. The 6 represents those 6 different health areas you see in the illustrations. The 18 refers to public health proven interventions that fit naturally into traditional preventive clinical care. And so we've got now packets of information that public health folks can use as they fight to get to the table with the insurers and the providers to say, pay for these. We know that if they pay for some of those, that frees up public health dollars as well. And those, just to give you an example of those include things that are pretty clinical, like medications for smoking cessation, for high blood pressure, for other chronic disease conditions. It's not having any cost sharing, no copay, no $10 copay, nothing. Those should be simply free. We've just seen the data that shows that part of the reason that the utilization isn't as good as it should be is because any barrier is sometimes enough, particularly for the vulnerable populations. But the 18 detail this. So that's bucket number one. Bucket number two recognizes that second trend that I mentioned earlier about moving from volume-based to value-based contracting. And it says, if you say to the clinicians, we're going to give you prospective money based on a dollar amount of per member patient per month, you can spend it however you want as long as you have high quality care and the patients stay healthy. That really frees up clinicians to think outside the box. Here, public health can be helpful in terms of pushing them outside the box by saying, we've got some real experiences that show how this can be done. So one of those Dr. Mullen was mentioning is really about paying for community health workers. So we know from a lot of experience in public health that community health workers in a number of different arenas can be helpful in terms of improving health and even reducing cost. But in particular in terms of improving health. But it's been really hard to get community health workers paid for under a fee-for-service system. Under value-based contracting, much easier. The flexibility of a patient-centered medical home to just hire on staff community health workers and employ them in a routine manner. Another type of example is a team approach in home monitoring of high blood pressure. So again, part of that high blood pressure statistic not being where it should be is related to the fact that it's difficult when you're an elderly person, you're come out of the hospital, you don't have a lot of support in the home, you're taking a lot of medications, they're new, they don't always make you feel good. Figuring out how to get your blood pressure controlled without constantly making an appointment to go back to your doctor is a challenge. Under value-based contracting, you can pay for things like home-based monitoring with a connection into your clinicians. You can pay for the time it may take a nurse to talk to you on the phone, which fee-for-service won't be covered. It can pay for including in the team the pharmacist that may be closer to where you live, so you could go to the pharmacist to check your blood pressure or have your medications adjusted rather than having to make the doctor's appointment. So these are the kind of creative approaches that become available in value-based contracting. It also could mean you can begin to pay for some of the community services like the quitline that has historically, tobacco quitline, historically been paid for by public health. If this is a helpful clinical asset to a practice, under value-based contracting, it's conceivable you could divert resources there. What's bucket three? So bucket three is the more traditional community-wide approach, and it's the one that we heard about that's working on housing and working with creating the appropriate conditions in communities that maximize health. And historically, the clinical system hasn't really paid attention to this. There are tests that are going on around the country now. You heard me pushing the clinical system into bucket two. There are also efforts now to push into three and to say maybe some resources from the healthcare delivery system should invest in changing conditions in the communities so that patients are more likely to be healthier. If you're getting reimbursed on the value-based and you want those healthier patients, that matters. You've seen, I won't go through this, you've seen it before, I think the public health pyramid that suggests the place to work is lower on the pyramid if we want to reach lots of people. And there's some grants that already pay for this. A lot of new attention, I think, is focused on investing in changing those conditions. These are just some of those that are either foundation or government-based. You heard Dr. Mullen also mentioning the National Prevention Strategy. So this represents a real effort on the part of the federal government to say, every single health federal agency should be involved in working on improving health. And Bridget Ulin, raise your hand, Bridget, from CDC, has overseen the work of the National Prevention Council together with the Surgeon General staff to really involve the other federal agencies in thinking about this and thinking about how their policies should be supporting the kind of activities that we've heard about. I would just mention one component of this that links up with what Dr. Mullen was mentioning is the council is also now developing a healthy aging action plan, which has come out of the White House conference on healthy aging in April. And from that council, the National Domestic Policy Council was charged with coming up with action steps and ask the Surgeon General and the National Prevention Council to have all of those federal agencies involved in thinking what could they do to promote healthy aging as part of that global creating healthier communities. CDC is also encouraging more attention to the data that we need in order to pay attention to social determinants of health. So we're about to release this website. It's not quite up yet, but it will be in 2 weeks, that will put together for the first time all of the available data sources for social determinants of health that may be helpful for people who are working in health and want to consider those as quality outcome measures. This is important to have in making the case back to the clinical community that there are, in fact, real measures that you should be looking at that are linked to better health, and that if you pay attention to those and think about those in terms of incorporating in terms of quality measures, you can. There's a scientific argument to be made for redirecting some of those resources. Another source of potential funding to work at, particularly to work at that community level, relates to the requirement of the Affordable Care Act that nonprofit hospitals had to develop community health needs assessments and then efforts to try to fill those gaps. not just have community benefits that were directed towards better relations of hospitals with their affiliated agencies, but redirecting those resources so they actually work towards improving community health in conjunction with public health folks. This has been very unevenly implemented around the country. There are both examples where people say nothing's happened, and then there are examples where people say this has really made a big difference. But the potential is there. We should take advantage of that potential. This is an existing website CDC has developed. That's the way to get onto it, the address there. And it gives tools to people that work at the community level and tools to the hospitals to move towards redirecting those community benefits towards better community health. And then just a final website that we're also working on is one that's a Health and All Policies Resource Center. This is also being done in conjunction with the National Prevention Council, and the idea here too is giving best practices, giving resources to people in public health departments to make those connections, to attend those meetings, whether they're for a health impact assessment planning process or to work with housing developers, so that there are people assigned to work in those arenas that are learning from the experience and best practices of others. So I would just close by saying the challenge is there. This is an extraordinary time. We have to figure out how to adjust both the healthcare and the public health system to make sure that the resources are appropriately aligned to capture the goals that we're talking about. But the conditions do exist for the potential to do that. And if we focus our attention and take advantage of those opportunities, there really is potential for us to make significant improvements. Thanks.
Wow, that's been an impressive panel. And now, if you thought that nothing could top this, we have Andy Dannenberg here to be our discussant. And Andy is actually one of the fathers, I would say, of health impact assessments. He is now an affiliate professor at the University of Washington, and he has faculty appointments in both public health and urban planning. Makes good sense, right? And he was formerly the team lead for the Healthy Community Design Initiative at CDC. His primary mode of transportation is his bicycle. And you probably didn't know that he got here today using the Chicago's bike share to attend this conference. So please, Andy.
Thank you, Kathy. I had to give a plug for the bike share. Chicago has done a very nice job of putting them in many places. And since many of us are staying downtown, there are bike share right near the hotels and places to bring them right here, and it actually works very well. I was asked to provide a few discussant comments on the wonderful talks we just heard, and we'll give a few thoughts on them. I can talk about HIA sort of indefinitely. I teach an entire course on HIA. I've worked in it extensively, as Kathy mentioned. Let me just give a few thoughts on it, and then when we get to discussion, can go whatever direction is useful. HIA has been around for about 20-something years, essentially started in Europe, first came to this country kind of early 2000s, so I've been working with about 10, 12 years. Health Impact Project with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trust has been a very major supporter of it, as well as CDC working with it, particularly while I was at CDC, and they continue to support it over time. And the field really has been growing. HIA itself is basically common sense. It's when we've talked about it in a number of settings, people say, what's new or why aren't you doing that anyway? It's essentially, in one sense, looking at the health consequences of proposals. Can we make it better by looking through a health lens at something that's being proposed? It can range from what is essentially a desktop review. Here's a proposal of something we're going to do, have a health person look at it, and I think probably most of you or any health officer can look at a proposal and say, here's something good or bad about it from the health point of view, and come up with recommendations of how to either improve it, to encourage it if it's something that's already helpful, or to mitigate any of the adverse consequences. In general, it does not stop projects. It's not intended to stop projects. There are a few examples of where something really terrible was being proposed, where it did contribute to killing something bad. But in general, even when a project isn't great, if the political will that's moving forward, then what HIA can do is mitigate the bad parts of it. And sometimes those mitigations can really be, you know, make a major difference from the health point of view. On the other extreme, from a desktop review, are the ones such as I think both Proctor Creek and the HUD agency designated housing rule, where you do need some substantial resources, and they can take many months or a year or more to go through it in great detail. You probably could look at some of those projects if all you had was a small amount of resource and get some of the ideas of what's needed relatively quickly. But the more detailed look, and particularly when you want a more quantitative look, does take some time and some resource to be able to move it forward. We have spent some time looking at impact evaluations, saying, do they make a difference? Does providing information actually change some decisions? And there's starting to be more literature out there of where actual changes are being made. So, for example, you heard in Proctor Creek, where it came up and said these are good for the community, and it did end up leading to some changes there. On the new HUD ruling, was it too early to know what impact that will have? But by looking at that from the health point of view, my guess is that some of those recommendations will be incorporated and start to make a difference there. I think one of the things I heard about HIA early on that I think continues to be true is that HIA is probably one of our most important tools for looking at equity and health disparity issues. That when you look at a project, the health lens is what lets you look at who is being affected, who in the vulnerable populations are being affected, particularly aging populations, persons with disabilities. But low-income minority populations, children, the whole range of vulnerable populations, HIA lets you look at those issues and make recommendations. There's a movement called 8 and 80, that if you make a setting good for 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds, you've really made it good for everybody. And generally, the changes that would make it good for your more vulnerable populations really do make it better. So, for example, you know, we put in wheelchair ramps. Well, generally need them now under ADA, but that does make it easier for the wheelchair, but for the cyclist and for someone who, you know, can't take a large step down, but for a whole range of ages, that's something that does help a vulnerable population, really helps the whole population. A couple of things I just want to mention that came up along this. One is the importance of working with partners, and I think a lot of that fits under this health and all policies that's the theme of the entire conference. Health and all policies is working with other sectors. That's really the core part of what that term means. And a big part of HIA generally, or most of the time, is looking at working across sectors. We don't usually do an HIA of a health project. We don't need an HIA of a vaccine program. We already look at vaccine effectiveness. Does this vaccine work for what it's needed for? And so you wouldn't really do what you call an HIA. You would look at, does the vaccine work, and you know, do it for health reasons. HIA is really focused on other sectors that typically do not look at the health aspects. And so we've had major linkages across sectors, such as transportation, which doesn't particularly consider health as central to its message, to its intent, and it really does have major health implications. And so we've had some very good interactions with the transportation sector. There's just a talk this morning, I think there'll be some more talks about what's called the Transportation Health Tool, which is a collaboration between the U.S. Department of Transportation and CDC, looking at the health implications of transportation decisions. And that's really a very major step forward. It's really just being released now by CDC and Department of Transportation to improve transportation projects from the health point of view. But that working with partners and working across sectors really makes a big difference. One other thing I want to mention, and John mentioned the approach of strengthening public health and healthcare collaboration, and that is a very important approach to advancing public health. Within that, he also mentioned the community benefits for nonprofit hospitals. And what has happened under that is, I think initially from what I've heard, and some of you may have more information, is many of those community benefits would be looking at areas such as, well, we'll provide some more pro bono care for vulnerable populations who don't have insurance, or we'll set up a blood pressure screening program that already are health-oriented, and already are healthcare that aren't really that big a stretch for what the hospital may already have been doing. And in some cases may even have, you know, an economic interest that we screen a few more people, we might get a few more patients here or something. So not totally separate from what their central interest was. But we've started to have a few examples of where a healthcare facility can really reach out into the community and do things that improve the overall community. And the one example, and I'm hoping there are more of them, this is one I've heard of. In Little Rock, Arkansas, a group of cardiologists, their interest is, you know, taking care of heart patients, decided that, you know, healthcare and prevention really matter. And they contributed substantial resources to helping build the Arkansas River Trail. They actually went out with that physical improvement to the built environment around them. They call it the Medical Mile. And you can look up Medical Mile, Little Rock, Arkansas, and you'll see the story. But it was taking a clinical group saying, we can do more on the prevention part of heart disease. Yeah, we're still going to get plenty of patients. Plenty of people will have heart disease. But we can do something more for the community, and did that outreach to contribute to that. And that's the type of thing that I would hope over time community benefits could start to look at some of those broader issues. I work a lot with built environment, and so when you make a built environment change, that's a long-lasting intervention that really can help a lot of people over time. Let me stop with that, because the questions and comments are always very interesting, so I look forward to contributing to that as we go to the comments. So, thank you.
Thank you. All right, with all these wonderful panelists and discussants, does anyone have any questions? Yes. John, you want to come up here so they can hear? Just run up. Yeah.
You know, I think you raise a really important question, and I think we have to work on it. So I think the first issue is, what do we know? You know, have we paid enough attention to what we know? And I think the answer is, we haven't paid enough attention to it, that we need to really make sure that we're trying to do a better job of gathering the information that already exists and filling the gaps when we think that, when we have reason to believe that something's going to make an actual difference in terms of a health outcome. And at CDC, we're engaged now in a project where we're trying to synthesize the information that CDC has gathered over a long period of time, and just not packaged in a way that may be making that argument. We're going to try to develop over the next 6 months the kind of packages I was mentioning in 618, but instead for the upstream efforts, so that we could make a stronger argument, synthesizing it in a discrete way. The second thing I would say, though, is by and large, the healthcare community doesn't care about 20-year changes, though. The healthcare community, I'm not talking here about providers and clinicians who obviously do, but I'm talking about the financial interests of the healthcare delivery system are much shorter than that. It's not that they're greedy, that's the system. We want to pay less premiums, people want a return on investment. It's really hard to make the 20-year argument from a business perspective. So I think what makes the most sense in terms of pitching to the healthcare delivery system for upstream is the things we know work short term. And there are some. There's, you know, you increase taxes on cigarettes, people stop smoking the next year. You add fluoride, you know, people's oral health gets better quickly. So there's some things that we know can happen in that window. I think we need to do better evidence on everything and then decide which ones are the ones we're going to have more success in making the pitch to the healthcare delivery system, because we can operate within their time zone and there is solid data which shows that they really can make that connection. We won't get all of it, But I think our strongest arguments has to be science-based and through the lens that they're considering, which is more time-limited.
And I'll just throw out that APHA is trying to make a change in a generation, right? That's our big goal. Yes, the man in the blue shirt. Right here. Yeah.
John, don't get too comfortable in your seat. So I realize you used to be in Massachusetts, but you're now in Georgia, where I also live. And Georgia, as you know, was an outlier. South is the land of belts. Everything bad for development, now part of the Medicaid, not expansion belt. And so I'm worried about two things. Number one, the policy environment there is you don't invest upstream and you accept poor outcomes downstream. So I'm wondering how in an environment where if we capture any savings, they will be reallocated in lower taxes rather than upstream in southern states. And I also worry about the healthcare gorilla, which will worry about retaining the dollars rather than sharing them, despite evidence that will suggest that investing upstream will actually be a good thing. And what your thoughts are just about, through a policy lens, how to manage not only the policies that make sense, but the political environment as well.
Oh boy, you're everyone really.
Really brief.
Okay, so I mean, the first thing I would say is I actually think good work is going on in every community and can go on in every community. And I'm so glad that you used as your example in the health impact assessment, a project that was in Atlanta. I mean, I actually been impressed in Atlanta that there really are focused efforts around good health. And I know the health commissioners and health activists in say, Mississippi, that we're always at the bottom, and they're really efforts in every state to try, I think, to pay attention to these issues. I think you have to adapt to the conditions that you're in, and I think and figure out what's palatable. But I think, and that means pulling some different policies and approaches, depending on the conditions. But I think it's possible to work on these issues in any environment. You just have to be creative and flexible, and you know, really, I think relying on the community and allies. So.
Yes, right here.
I think that some of the work that's being done is probably geared to those of us who are in the field, and you're telling us how to work. I wonder who's working with the educational institutions to make sure that that interdisciplinary training is happening, so that when the next cadre comes out, this new generation comes out, that they're prepared to think about health in these very coordinated ways.
Go ahead, Andy.
I've been working in that area. We have at University of Washington and probably at least 20 other schools around the country courses on health and built environment, where we try to get public health and planning students in the same classroom. And I'd say the next generation gets it. I mean, it's obviously self-selected who shows up for those courses, but there's some real excitement there, and I think the message is slowly getting there through the educational system.
Yeah.
So over the past 2 years, the Association of Schools and Programs for Public Health have been convening a number of people on a Framing the Future Task Force, looking at the educational curriculum for master's and doctoral level public health training. And in those discussions and recommendations, there's been a lot of reference to the importance of not only teaching about collaboration, but actual experiential learning. So I think that there's one hope for the workforce for the future. And then my successor, my counterpart, commissioner from the state of Minnesota, Dr. Ed Ellinger, who's the current ASCO president, is leading his current presidential challenge, which is really focusing on the social determinants of health and the health equity triple aim. And he is, I think, if not right now, in a half hour, going to be speaking with the Surgeon General and some others on a panel, though it might have been here, and thank you for coming here instead, talking about those very issues. Yes.
Impact of various issues around the Affordable Care Act. So we're seeing
rise of high deductible. We're seeing really big changes in terms of medication costs for patients, including our pharmacists are telling us that their patients are in the donut hole already this year. And I was very intrigued, John, when you raised this whole question about how much of our responsibility is monitoring some of these unexpected, unforeseen scenarios that are occurring, and then what is our role in advocating, because literally we're seeing dramatic shifts in the cost of what was previously generic drugs.
Do you want to try?
I guess I would argue, I think public health people have a really important role to play there. And I think the role, in part, can be collaborating with consumer-oriented organizations that are also concerned about these issues, but may not have as ready access to some of the tables and meetings where the discussions take place. But in general, I think my argument would be that public health should be at the table and should be when discussions are occurring about policies related to healthcare delivery, including, you know, with the larger insurers, and that if there isn't a sort of a forum like a state innovation model collective forum that's already established where it makes sense to try to get to that table, I think a role could be the convener of groups to talk about those concerns, their implications, and highlighting the potential harm that could come from certain policies being in. So I think it's an important role.
Anybody else? Going once. Oh, yes.
I was going to ask, related to the 618 project, is that out or available for us to detail that?
Oh, so yes, and we're going to have a website that's going to be with all the materials that I've been referencing, that we're just working on the final things of getting it up there. It'll be ready in, I think, mid-November. But I have a limited number of the flyers with me, which I can hand out today, and we can. I'm trying to think about how. I would say check CDC's website in 2 weeks, and we'll have the materials available there. But those of you who are really eager to see something today, I've got it.
Right. Well, let me just only say, okay, raffle tickets. We've got an event tonight. How many of you in the room are with the Aging and Public Health section? How many with public, what's it called, maternal and child health? EPI? Statistics? Healthcare? Whichever ones I didn't mention. Well, anyway, tonight you are all welcome to come to our reception for our section. We actually raise money for the future leaders in public health and aging, and we have raffle tickets. There's two people raising their hands right now, Steve Wallace and Emily Nicklett. It's free food, it's a lot of fun, and then we have an auction, which I'll be the auctioneer. It'll be a lot of fun, really, and Emily will help me out. But anyway, let me have us all give a big applause for our panelists and discussants.